Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
U.S.-Iran negotiations have been suspended by Tehran amid escalating Iranian military enforcement of a maritime traffic separation scheme in the Strait of Hormuz and linked to regional hostilities. The Russian spring-summer 2026 offensive in Ukraine has culminated with a net loss of controlled territory, prompting a shift toward mass retaliatory strikes on Ukrainian civilian centers and deepening logistical reliance on Belarusian and North Korean resources. Concurrently, the People's Republic of China and North Korea are expanding direct military, intelligence, and espionage cooperation with the Russian Federation, further complicating the global threat landscape.
Okay, so welcome to the deep dive, everyone. I want you to imagine a world where a drone strike in the Middle East, right, directly dictates the price of a gallon of gas in Tokyo.
Right.
And then that price shift somehow tips the balance of a really grinding war in Eastern Europe. I mean, we're not just looking at isolated incidents on a map today.
No, not at all. It's completely interwoven.
Exactly. We are looking at a massive web of global crises that are just colliding. So our mission today is to give you a neutral, factual, and, you know, deeply analytical review of the current reporting. We're looking at late May and early June 2026 intelligence assessments.
Yeah, drawing heavily on the Institute for the Study of War and the Critical Threats Project for this one.
Right. And the overarching theme here, the thing you really need to take away, is that this is a highly interconnected global security environment. Like, a tactical shift in one theater is instantly sending shockwaves into another.
It's a completely fused threat landscape.
Oh.
You really can't look at the Middle East or Eastern Europe or the Indo-Pacific in isolation anymore. I mean, they are deeply linked by the tactics being used, the weapons being shared, and, you know, the economic leverage.
Yeah.
And to really understand how this machinery works, we have to start in the Middle East. Specifically, looking at Iran and the sudden suspension of their bilateral negotiations with the U.S.
So let's unpack this, because the recent reporting lays out this really fascinating timeline. Like, between May 28 and June 1, the draft for a U.S.-Iran Memorandum of Understanding and MOU basically just hit a brick wall.
Yeah, it completely stalled.
And it stalled because of some very specific amendments that were requested by the U.S. administration. So what were these amendments, and why did they just shatter the whole framework?
Well, it really comes down to the difference between a promise and an actual physical action. So the previous drafts of this MOU, they were built on a framework where Iran would commit, you know, on paper to not pursuing a nuclear weapon.
Right.
But the text lacked explicit, immediate commitments for Iran to physically hand over its stockpile of highly enriched uranium.
The HEU, right.
Exactly. And it didn't explicitly mandate an immediate halt to their enrichment. Instead, the draft proposed that these really critical nuclear issues would be, quote, discussed during a 60-day window after signing.
Wait, hold on. So the original draft basically said, let's sign the deal today, give you all the economic benefits, and then we'll spend the next 2 months sort of figuring out how to take away your highly enriched uranium.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, that sounds like a massive loophole.
It was a huge point of friction. And that's exactly why the U.S. requested these highly specific amendments in late May. They targeted exactly how and when that HEU would be secured. The administration wanted immediate structural concessions, not a 60-day buffer.
Right, which makes sense.
But the nuclear issue was actually only half of the equation here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the other amendment was about the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. publicly demanded the immediate opening of the strait without any tolls, and they also demanded the removal of Iranian naval mines from the waterway.
Wow. Okay. Because the Strait of Hormuz is essentially the jugular vein of the global energy economy.
Absolutely.
So demanding it be toll-free and clear of mines is a direct challenge to how Iran currently operates in those waters.
It is. And in response to these demands, Iran officially suspended the negotiations on June 1st. Now, intelligence assessments indicate the regime is currently dominated by the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, specifically Commander Major General Ahmad Vahidi and his inner circle.
Right. But what I find truly wild is the official justification they gave for suspending the talks.
Oh, the deflection tactic.
Yeah. Because they didn't just come out and say, you know, we refuse to give up our uranium. That would look terrible on the international stage.
Right. They need a narrative.
Instead, they claimed they were suspending talks because of the ongoing Israeli military operations against Hezbollah in Lebanon. You literally had the Supreme Leader's advisor saying that any agreement that excludes Hezbollah is irrelevant.
Yeah. They're using a conflict in the Levant as a precondition for a nuclear deal.
Exactly. So how do we interpret that? Like, what is Vahidi's actual game plan here?
It's textbook diplomatic deflection, really. By demanding that any U.S.-Iran agreement inherently resolve the Hezbollah-Israel conflict, they're just buying time.
Oh.
They're taking a negotiation about ending U.S.-Iran friction, which is, you know, about their nuclear program and the maritime extortion, and trying to turn it into a negotiation about Lebanon, which is an arena where Iran and Hezbollah have these maximalist, almost impossible demands.
Right.
So analysts assess this clearly indicates Vahidi actually prefers the current status quo.
Because the status quo works for them. I mean, think about it. Under the current reality, they haven't had to make any real concessions on their uranium. They still control the Strait of Hormuz. They avoid a conventional war, and they keep leveraging their proxy network. Like, why sign a deal when operating in the gray zone is so profitable for them?
Exactly. And speaking of profitable, that brings us to the massive economic sticking points that also derailed this whole thing.
The frozen assets.
Right. Unfreezing $12 billion in Iranian assets was a major friction point. The U.S. stated publicly that no money would be exchanged. But on the flip side, Iranian negotiators, especially the ones close to Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagar Ghalibaf, they mandated that irreversible access to those funds was a strict precondition.
So it's a total standoff. Iran wants the $12 billion up front to mitigate their domestic pressure, and the U.S. is saying, no, give us the uranium first.
Exactly.
And speaking of that domestic pressure in Iran, there's some really compelling intelligence about internal regime friction, but I want to heavily caveat this for you all listening. This is strictly a developing and unverified claim.
Yes, very important to note that.
But on May 31st, anti-regime media reported that Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian actually submitted a resignation letter to Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei.
Yeah, and supposedly he used this unprecedented, highly critical tone to attack the IRGC's outsized role in the government.
Right. Now, Iranian state media firmly denied this. We cannot independently verify there was a letter. But even the rumor is fascinating, because the president in Iran is basically just a bureaucratic manager, while the supreme leader and the IRGC hold all the actual power.
Right. And they hold the guns.
So this rumor aligns perfectly with what we are verifiably seeing, which is a massive consolidation of power by the hardliners.
Oh, the institutional consolidation is undeniable at this point.
Yeah.
Just look at May 25. The Iranian parliament reelected Ghalibaf as speaker for a seventh consecutive term.
Wow, a seventh term.
Yeah, he secured 235 out of 285 votes. It's exceptionally rare for the parliament to oust an incumbent during these annual presidium elections, but a seventh term, it totally cements his grip.
And he's a hardliner.
Right. He's central to their negotiating delegation. His re-election guarantees that the legislative branch stays in absolute lockstep with the IRGC and the supreme leader. There is no moderate buffer left in that government.
And when a regime becomes that rigid, you know, that dominated by the military, it inevitably spills outward. Which brings us perfectly to the maritime escalation in the Strait of Hormuz.
Right.
The intelligence shows this highly coordinated effort by the IRGC Navy to set up a brand new, completely illegal baseline for international shipping. Walk us through this traffic separation scheme they're doing.
So the IRGC Navy is actively trying to legitimize a coercive transit regime. They're actually publishing these daily roll-ups of compliant vessels to make it look like some official internationally recognized protocol.
Like it's totally normal.
Yeah, like, oh, we processed 20 vessels on May 30 and 24 vessels on June 2. They claim they're granting safe passage, but it's fundamentally an extortion racket.
Yeah.
They are charging commercial vessels fees to pass through international waters, and they sanitize it by calling them protection fees and environmental fees.
I mean, it's literally the geopolitical equivalent of a mobster walking into your business and saying, nice cargo ship, be ashamed if something happened to it, just pay the environmental fee.
That is exactly what it is.
And the U.S. demand for unrestricted shipping obviously rejects this. So what happens if a commercial vessel just says, no, we aren't paying your fake toll? How is the IRGC enforcing it?
Through sheer kinetic coercion, they use force. On June 1st, the UK Maritime Trade Operations reported that an unspecified projectile struck a Panama-flagged cargo vessel.
The MSC Sariska V.
Yes. It was transiting the northern Persian Gulf off the coast of Iraq. And then a few hours later, a second impact caused a fire on board. Iraqi officials assessed that the second impact was likely a drone.
So they are actively shooting drones at civilian cargo ships just to prove they control the water.
Yes.
And they aren't just targeting commercial entities either. There was a massive kinetic exchange the day before that on May 31.
Yeah, that was major. IRGC Media and U.S. Central Command both confirmed that Iranian air defenses shot down a U.S. MQ-1 Predator drone.
Wow.
Now, obviously, the narrative's conflicted. Iran claimed the drone violated their airspace.
Yeah.
But CNTCon clarified it was strictly over international waters.
Yeah.
But the U.S. response was immediate.
They didn't just let it slide.
No. CNTCom conducted defensive strikes targeting the Iranian air defense systems that shot down the drone, along with a ground control station and launch sites on Keshem Island and in Gurukh.
And the IRGC didn't just absorb that, right? They escalated again.
Yeah, they launched two ballistic missiles explicitly targeting U.S. forces stationed in Kuwait.
Which is a massive escalation. Fortunately, Kuwaiti air defenses intercepted them. But let's look at this whole trajectory. You have illegal tolls, commercial ships getting hit by drones, U.S. surveillance aircraft shot down, U.S. retaliatory strikes, and then ballistic missiles fired at American troops in a neighboring country. This is a severe escalation cycle. So what is the U.S. doing to dismantle the administrative side of this protection racket, you know, aside from dropping bombs?
Well, the U.S. Treasury Department took decisive action on May 27. They officially sanctioned the Persian Gulf Strait Authority, the PGSA.
And the PGSA.
Yeah, that's the bureaucratic organization Iran established to formalize their control over the strait. They're the ones forcing the commercial vessels to pay the fees. By sanctioning them, the Treasury is issuing a clear warning. Any actor that cooperates with the PGSA faces secondary sanctions from the U.S.
And for those of you who might not follow financial warfare, secondary sanctions are incredibly powerful. It's basically the U.S. government saying, look, you can do business with Iran's PGSA, or you can do business with the United States financial system, but you cannot do both.
Exactly.
It forces global shipping companies to choose, and everyone chooses the U.S. dollar. It's a direct move to bankrupt this maritime racket.
Right. But Iran's strategy doesn't rely on just one choke point. To understand their posture, you really have to look at the entire axis of resistance. They use proxy forces across different fronts to apply interconnected pressure.
So let's look at Lebanon, because the situation there is incredibly volatile right now. There was supposed to be a U.S.-mediated partial ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that agreement seems to be fraying. The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, have actually expanded their ground offensives. They've pushed north of the Litani River. And the tactical details are really fascinating here. On May 31st, the IDF captured Beaufort Castle.
Wait, Beaufort Castle? Like the literal Crusader-era fortress on a cliff?
Very same.
Why on earth is a modern, mechanized army prioritizing the capture of a medieval castle in 2026? I mean, that sounds archaic.
It does, but the geography of that castle neutralizes a very modern threat. That elevated position is vital for observing ground movements. But more importantly, taking high ground is a direct response to a major tactical adaptation by Hezbollah.
Okay, what adaptation?
Hezbollah has started fielding first-person view, or FPV, drones that are equipped with thermal cameras.
Ah, wow. So that changes the entire geometry of the battlefield.
Completely.
Traditionally, infantry could use the cover of darkness to move around safely. But if your enemy has cheap drones with thermal optics, the night doesn't protect you anymore.
Precisely. It allows Hezbollah to conduct precision nighttime attacks. By capturing Beaufort Castle, the IDF secures a dominant line of sight and elevation. It makes it much harder for those low-flying drones to approach undetected or use the terrain for ambushes.
That is just a perfect example of ancient geography meeting cutting-edge warfare.
It really is.
And as the IDF adapts in Lebanon, we are seeing the rest of Iran's axis of resistance spin up an information operation to try and stop them. We've seen IRGC commanders and senior Houthi officials explicitly threatening to, quote-unquote, activate the Bab el-Mandeb Strait.
Yeah, threatening to resume mass attacks on shipping in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. And their stated goal is to pressure the U.S. into forcing Israel to halt its operations in Lebanon.
So again, the interconnectedness.
Exactly. Iran links maritime security in the Red Sea directly to the survival of its proxy on the Mediterranean coast.
It's an extortion strategy played out across multiple seas. And, you know, we see it extending into the political realm in Iraq, too. According to Iraqi media, the U.S. has been putting intense pressure on the Iraqi Prime Minister-designate Ali al-Zaidi. They explicitly stated they'll oppose any Iranian-backed Iraqi militia participating in the next government.
Yeah, the U.S. even warned they might sever relations with any Iraqi ministry handed over to those groups.
Which prompted a really interesting, probably fake response, right?
Very likely fake, yeah. The prominent Iranian-backed group Ashab al-Al-Haq announced they formed an internal committee to, quote, disengage from the popular mobilization forces.
Right, but I'm guessing the intelligence analysts aren't buying it.
Not at all. Analysts assess this is almost certainly just a political maneuver, a facade to relieve immediate U.S. pressure on the prime minister during the government formation process. They'll change their letterhead, you know, but they aren't giving up their guns.
Right. You have to separate the political posturing from the operational reality. And when we look at the reality of what Iran is doing, using asymmetric proxies, mastering drone warfare, weaponizing logistics, it's not happening in a vacuum. It actually provides a perfect analytical bridge to what's happening in Eastern Europe right now.
It really does.
Because the drone supremacy and the targeting of logistics we see in the Middle East are the exact same forces actively reshaping the battlefield in Ukraine. Which brings us to the Russian offensive campaign updates.
Yeah, let's talk about the culmination of the Russian spring-summer 2026 offensive. Because the data on this paints a stark, almost paradoxical picture of the offensive's actual efficacy over the last 6 months.
All right, lay the math on us. Let's hear the metrics.
So between December 2025 and May 2026, Russian forces managed to gain a presence in only 40.64 square kilometers of territory.
Okay, about 40 square kilometers gained.
Right. But concurrently, during that exact same time frame, Russian forces actually lost control of 281.1 square kilometers.
Wait, okay. We need to pause and clarify this metric for you guys listening, because military terminology can be really tricky. When you say Russia lost control of 281 square kilometers, we are not saying that Ukrainian forces mounted some sweeping World War II-style counteroffensive and liberated all those towns.
Well, no. That isn't what happened.
Based on the methodology, this reflects a shift in the battlefield geometry from being explicitly Russian-controlled to a contested, infiltrated status.
Exactly. It means the area has become a gray zone. It's a space where neither side can exercise absolute control. And the primary reason for this is pervasive drone surveillance tied to artillery fire control.
So if a Russian unit tries to hold a trench in that 280 square kilometer zone,
a Ukrainian drone spots them, and artillery eliminates them.
And vice versa, right. If Ukraine tries to move in, a Russian drone spots them.
Exactly. It prevents consolidation by anyone.
So the objective reality on the ground is that the Russian offensive didn't just fail to move forward. It actually resulted in a net loss of controlled territory. It ground to a bloody halt. But this brings up a huge question about the psychology of authoritarian systems. How is the Russian high command portraying these highly unfavorable metrics internally? Like, what is Putin actually seeing on his desk?
Well, he's seeing a fabricated reality. The intelligence assesses that the Russian military command is systematically providing heavily exaggerated maps and falsified progress reports to Putin.
They're literally lying about the battlefield to the commander-in-chief.
Yes, they are.
I mean, it's the classic dictator's trap. No one wants to be the general who walks into Putin's office and says, "Sir, we spent tens of thousands of lives over the last 6 months, and we mathematically lost ground."
Exactly. So they cook the books, they draw the lines a little further west than they actually are.
But what is the strategic consequence of that lie?
It creates a false perception of tactical success at the highest levels. If the leadership believes the offensive is succeeding, it heavily disincentivizes them from pursuing any diplomatic off-ramps or negotiations.
Right. Why negotiate a ceasefire if you think you're winning?
Exactly. And it prevents them from making necessary recalculations regarding defense spending or strategy. So they double down on a flawed operational design, sending more men into the meat grinder based on maps that are basically fiction.
That's wild. And a major driver of that meat grinder and why Russia is losing control of these gray zones is a strategy the Ukrainian defense minister calls the logistics lockdown. And I find this absolutely fascinating because it's not just about dropping grenades on frontline trenches anymore.
No, this is a systematic mid-range strike campaign. Ukrainian forces have successfully established drone-enabled fire control over major Russian ground lines of communication, or GLOCs.
And just to quickly define that jargon for everyone, GLOCs, we're basically talking about the major highways, railways, and dirt roads that serve as the vital arteries feeding the front line, right?
Correct. And Ukraine has extended this fire control up to 90 kilometers deep into occupied territory.
90 kilometers.
Yeah. Persistent drone surveillance and strike capabilities over critical logistical hubs in occupied Luhansk, like Starobilsk and Olchevsk. They also have persistent interdiction along the M14 Rostov-Crimea highway.
That is massive. That means a Russian ammunition truck is in mortal danger for 2 hours before it even reaches the zero line. That level of deep interdiction prevents the massing of personnel and halts heavy artillery shells. I mean, you can't mount an offensive if your bullets never make it to the guns.
Right.
So how on earth are Russian forces attempting to adapt to this drone threat on their supply lines?
The adaptations are extreme and, frankly, pretty desperate. According to reports from the Antesh Partisan Group, which is a resistance movement operating deep behind enemy lines, the Russian military has instituted incredibly strict policies for convoys on that M14 highway.
Like what?
They're required to move almost exclusively at night. And when they do move, they have to travel at speeds exceeding 120 kilometers per hour. And every single vehicle must carry a designated individual whose only job is to operate a handheld drone detector.
Imagine that. You're driving a heavy military supply truck dead of night, headlights off or dimmed, doing 75 miles an hour down a contested highway while the guy next to you is staring at a scanner waiting for a kamikaze drone. That is a logistical nightmare.
It is, but it gets even darker.
Okay, how so?
Because of the legal violations occurring as they try to adapt,
mm.
there are developing claims, widely discussed by Russian mule blockers and opposition sources, indicating that the Russian command has ordered the repainting and disguising of military logistics vehicles to make them look like civilian transport trucks or agricultural equipment.
Wait, hold on. That is a massive red flag. Intentionally disguising a military asset to shield it from attack, that's a direct violation of the Geneva Convention.
Yes.
That is the literal definition of the war crime of perfidy.
Right. Exactly. It constitutes perfidy. And beyond the legal aspect, it is operationally disastrous for the actual civilians living in those territories. By disguising military trucks as civilian vehicles, the Russian command intentionally blurs the targeting lines.
So it turns every legitimate civilian delivery truck or farmer's tractor into a potential target.
Yes, placing the civilian population at immense, unacceptable risk.
It's a horrific tactic born out of complete logistical desperation. And as the Russian military struggles to protect its rear and sustain its offensive, we're seeing a reactionary shift. They are lashing out. Since they can't advance on the ground, they're shifting toward mass retaliatory strikes aimed directly at Ukrainian civilian centers.
Analytically, it's an attempt to exploit perceived vulnerabilities in Ukrainian air defense and compensate for their own battlefield culmination. The most prominent example was overnight between June 1st and June 2. They launched a massive, highly complex strike package, heavily targeting Kyiv City.
Let's break down the sheer physics of what was in that strike package, because it really illustrates the immense strain on the defenders. They used a really diverse array of munitions.
And pretty diverse, yeah.
We're talking 8 Zircon hypersonic cruise missiles, 33 Iskander-M ballistic missiles, 27 KH-101 cruise missiles, and 5 Caliber cruise missiles, all layered alongside hundreds of Shahed loitering munitions and decoy drones.
It's designed to completely overwhelm the radar processing and interceptor capacity of the network. A hypersonic Zircon missile travels at incredible speeds, giving defenders almost zero reaction time. Ballistic Iskanders approach from a high parabolic arc. Meanwhile, the KH-101s and Calibers fly low to evade radar, and the slow, cheap Shahed drones just act as a sponge, soaking up expensive interceptor missiles.
It's a synchronized nightmare. And despite the incredible effectiveness of Ukrainian air defense, a barrage of that magnitude is going to have leakages. This specific strike resulted in at least 22 civilian fatalities and extensive damage in Kyiv. From a strategic standpoint, Moscow is trying to rapidly deplete localized shortages of Patriot interceptors.
Right. They know the West can only manufacture so many and they want to empty the magazines. But it's crucial to understand that the strain on air defense is not one-sided.
Oh, definitely not.
That logistics lockdown we just discussed has severely strained Russia's own air defense umbrella deep inside Russian territory. And the Kremlin's response to this is a fascinating admission of state failure.
Tell me about it.
The Russian Ministry of Defense has approved mechanisms allowing private businesses and enterprises to purchase their own anti-aircraft systems, radars, and mobile electronic warfare systems.
Okay, we need to pause on this because it is wild.
Yeah.
You are saying that if I own an oil refinery or a large manufacturing plant in Russia, the federal government is basically telling me, hey, the national military can't protect you from Ukrainian drones. You're on your own. Go buy a surface-to-air missile system.
It is exactly that. It's the total privatization of national defense.
It's like Walmart having to buy a Patriot missile battery to protect a distribution center.
Yes. We're seeing the financial and operational burden of air defense being shifted entirely away from the federal government and onto regional entities and private corporations. A prime example is the newly formed Ministry for the Protection of Nizhny Novgorod Oblast Facilities.
Wow.
It was created specifically by the regional government to coordinate local air defense because the federal military umbrella is stretched too thin.
This privatization of security highlights the broader economic and force generation strains plaguing the Russian state. I mean, the Kremlin is facing severe systemic challenges in recruiting enough personnel to replace the astronomical casualty rates they're taking.
And we can quantify that desperation, too. On May 25, President Putin signed a decree offering up to 10 million rubles in debt relief for new recruits and their spouses if they sign a contract with the Ministry of Defense.
10 million rubles. To put that in perspective for you all, that is life-changing money in rural Russia. That's the equivalent of the government offering to completely pay off your mortgage and clear all your credit card debt instantly just to get you to put on a uniform. But even with these massive incentives, what's the result?
Contract recruitment is still failing to meet operational requirements.
Because men are doing the math.
Right. They're realizing 10 million rubles isn't worth a near certain casualty rate. And this shortfall has triggered intense internal debates within the Kremlin. They are actively discussing the potential necessity of involuntary reserve call-ups.
Which is politically radioactive.
Very. Putin has desperately tried to avoid it to maintain domestic stability. And while they struggle for manpower, the economic foundation that funds the war is taking massive hits. Because of those successful Ukrainian drone strikes on major Russian oil refineries like Intuapse and Ilsky, it's actually facing a domestic energy crisis.
The data on this is striking. According to the St. Petersburg International Mercantile Exchange, Russian reliance on Belarusian energy exports has skyrocketed. Sales of Belarusian gasoline inside Russia are up 26 times compared to the exact same period last year.
And diesel sales are 3 times higher. It's severe enough that Russian authorities are considering capping diesel and jet fuel exports just to stabilize their own market.
Think about the irony there. One of the world's largest petrostates is having to import gasoline from Belarus because its own refineries keep getting blown up by drones.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Ukraine's international support remains robust in key technological areas. Like on May 28, Sweden officially pledged 36 Gripen fighter aircraft to Ukraine.
The Gripen is highly capable. As President Zelensky noted, these jets are critical for Ukraine's efforts to defend against Russian-guided glide bomb attacks. The Gripens have the radar and missile range to push Russian bombers further back, preventing them from dropping those massive 1,500-kilogram bombs on defensive lines.
And this creates a clear, logical transition for us. As the Russian military fails to secure decisive military victories and its economy fractures, the Kremlin is accelerating a much darker, long-term alternative strategy.
Right.
If they can't conquer new territory, they're going to intensify the administrative, demographic, and cultural absorption of the territories they already occupy. This brings us to the Russian occupation updates. The focus here is on demographic engineering and forced deportations, which were textbook violations of international humanitarian law.
The forced transfer of populations is not a byproduct of the war. It is a central pillar of the occupation strategy. We have verified reports detailing the forced transfer of Ukrainian political prisoners deep into Russia. For instance, Lyra Zemelova.
The Crimean Tatar political prisoner?
Yes. She was moved from occupied territory to a penal colony in Volgograd Oblast, deep inside Russia.
And the legality of this is black and white. This violates the Fourth Geneva Convention, which explicitly prohibits the deportation of civilians from occupied territory into the territory of the occupying power, regardless of the motive.
Exactly. And the scale is significant. Ukrainian General Prosecutor Ruslan Kravchenko submitted evidence to the ICC detailing the systematic deportation of over 1,800 Ukrainian prisoners from occupied Kherson and Mykolaiv oblasts alone.
But the demographic engineering doesn't stop at political prisoners. It extends to the youth. The Russian government is heavily funding an initiative called University Shifts.
Yeah, Prime Minister Mishustin allocated over 155 million rubles to this program. The stated goal is to transfer 2,300 Ukrainian teenagers from occupied territories into Russian pedagogical universities deep inside the country.
The official narrative is to immerse them in Russian educational events. But let's call it what it is. It's the textbook definition of youth Russification.
Absolutely.
It's a systematic effort to strip these teenagers of their heritage, instill a Russian civic identity, and permanently sever ties to their homeland, its cultural erasure. And this control is being codified at every administrative level.
In occupied Donetsk, they recently held a massive conference to declare 2026 as the Year of the Unity of the Peoples of Russia. It's a propaganda event. On an everyday level, the Zaporizhia Occupation Administration is actively drafting laws to enforce the absolute supremacy of the Russian language.
What does that actually look like on the ground?
Strict mandates to systematically replace any Latin or Ukrainian signage with Cyrillic characters across all businesses, street signs, public spaces. If you own a shop, you cannot have a Ukrainian sign. They are trying to erase the visual and linguistic reality of Ukraine.
And the administrative control also extends to property rights. The Ukrainian Resistance Center reported that the Mariupol Occupation Administration launched a large-scale wave of evictions. They are literally forcing residents out of their homes and transferring these seized properties into a municipal housing stock.
And once it's in that stock, it's slated for redistribution. Often these homes are given to Russian immigrants who are incentivized to move in. It's a deliberate tactic to alter the demographic makeup of the city. You evict the Ukrainians, you move in the Russians. Additionally, the Russian Ministry of Internal Affairs is actively drafting amendments to simplify the process of renouncing Ukrainian citizenship.
Now, at first glance, someone might think, well, simplifying paperwork is just bureaucracy. But why are they removing the requirement for official Russian translations of Ukrainian documents?
Because the forced passportization campaign is meeting massive local resistance. Ukrainian citizens are finding every loophole to avoid taking a Russian passport, because doing so often makes the men eligible for military conscription against their own country.
Right.
So they're simplifying the process not to be helpful, but to streamline the coercion.
That is incredibly grim. And alongside these demographic shifts, we're tracking the deep militarization of the youth. The integration of warfare into basic civilian education is becoming institutionalized. It's not just propaganda, it's tactical training.
For the 2026-2027 school year, institutions like the Romanov Hospitality College and the Simferopol College of Radio Electronics in occupied Crimea have received official federal licenses to run unmanned aerial vehicle operation courses.
Think about that. A hospitality college, a school meant to teach hotel management, is now teaching teenagers how to fly military drones.
Yeah.
Occupation officials say this is part of an end-to-end cycle of drone training starting from primary school. They're preparing a generation of children for a protracted, endless conflict.
And yet there's a jarring contrast between the narrative they present on TV and the reality on the ground. Russian officials consistently claim they're developing devastated cities like Mariupol and Berdyansk into thriving tourist hubs.
Right. Promising luxury hotels and marinas.
But you can't build a luxury resort when your supply lines are on fire. On May 30, Crimea occupation head Sergei Aksionov was forced to institute a severe fuel ration, a limit of 20 liters per day per person.
And this rationing was a direct result of the successful Ukrainian mid-range strikes we discussed earlier. The occupation minister of fuel and energy attempted to go on television and downplay it as a mere technical issue.
But you can't spend a 20-liter fuel ration in a supposed tourist destination. It highlights the systemic vulnerability of the Russian occupation apparatus.
Exactly. The facade of normalcy cannot withstand sustained logistical interdiction. But as we zoom out, we must remember Russia isn't operating in a geopolitical vacuum. Its ability to sustain this war is increasingly tied to strategic partnerships in Asia.
The web connects.
Exactly. Which brings us to the China and Taiwan updates. The diplomatic and military posture of the PRC is deeply intertwined with this global security environment. Let's start with a highly unusual diplomatic anomaly regarding the APEC meetings.
Yeah, this is fascinating. The PRC actually allowed a serving ministerial-level Taiwanese official to participate in an international forum hosted on mainland Chinese soil. From May 22 to 23, Taiwanese minister without portfolio, Yang Zheni, attended the APEC ministerial meeting in Suzhou.
Now, for anyone who follows cross-strait relations, this is highly irregular. Beijing's standard policy is to systematically constrain Taiwan's international participation.
Constantly.
We've seen this with them blocking Taiwan from the World Health Assembly and bullying nations to close airspace to the Taiwanese president's plane. So, why the exception? especially considering the current Taiwanese administration fundamentally rejects the 1992 consensus.
Right.
And just to briefly define that, the 1992 consensus is basically an alleged verbal agreement from decades ago that Beijing insists must be the baseline of cross-strait relations, the idea that there's only one China. The current administration rejects this. So why did Beijing permit Minister Yang's attendance amidst this ongoing campaign of exclusion?
Intelligence assesses this must be viewed through the lens of a sophisticated information operation. By allowing Taiwanese participation in an economic forum like APEC, the PRC achieves a strategic deception. They can present an outward facade of accommodation and reasonableness to foreign investors.
It's a classic bait and switch. Beijing plays the gracious host to look reasonable to global CEOs, while quietly kicking Taiwan under the table with military pressure back home.
Precisely. It obscures their broader coercive activities. It complicates the narrative, allowing China to say, look, we are being reasonable. Taiwan is the one being difficult.
And that dual-track strategy is starkly evident when we look at Taiwanese domestic politics and the actions of the PRC security apparatus. Within Taiwan, there's a significant political dispute fracturing the opposition KMT party. Former President Ma Ying-jeou ousted Xiao Hus following unverified but highly damaging allegations of unreported cash donations and secret meetings with the PRC's Taiwan Affairs Office Director in 2025.
While these internal rifts destabilize Taiwanese politics, the PRC is increasing its physical pressure on Taiwanese citizens traveling in mainland China. The Straits Exchange Foundation reported the arbitrary detention of three Yiguando religious followers in May 2026.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council reported that since January 2024, 313 Taiwanese individuals have faced severe civil liberty restrictions or disappearances while traveling in the PRC.
Why use these restrictions?
Yeah.
Because it creates a chilling effect. It sends a message. You are not safe here unless you comply with our worldview.
And that internal security posture reflects a broader prioritization of absolute ideology across the entire Chinese state, notably within the PLA. A May 27 report detailed that the Central Military Commission is explicitly prioritizing political and ideological loyalty among senior PLA cadres over operational competence.
This intense focus on ideological purity is dangerous. If you promote generals based on how loudly they praise the party, rather than how well they understand modern warfare, you surround the leadership with yes-men.
And that creates conditions where Xi Jinping might receive fundamentally inaccurate assessments regarding the PLA's actual readiness. If no general tells him their amphibious assault capabilities are flawed, he could catastrophically miscalculate his military's preparedness for an invasion.
It's the exact same fake map syndrome we just discussed with Putin.
Exactly.
And while ideological loyalty is prioritized domestically, the PRC's external intelligence gathering remains highly aggressive. On May 20, German authorities arrested a married couple operating as deep cover assets for the Chinese Ministry of State Security.
They were systematically targeting scientists at top-tier German universities, focusing on advanced dual-use technologies like aerospace engineering and militarized AI.
Why spend a decade developing militarized AI when you can just pay an asset to steal the blueprints from a NATO country?
Right. But stealing blueprints isn't enough. You need combat experience, which the PLA lacks. And their modernization is benefiting directly from Ukraine. A recent report flagged a massive development. The PLA secretly trained approximately 200 Russian military personnel at PRC facilities in late 2025.
That is a huge threshold to cross.
What were they training them on?
Advanced drone operations and complex mine-clearing techniques. It's a perfectly symbiotic relationship. Russia gets vital training, and the PRC gains invaluable real-world insights by observing how their technology performs in high-intensity combat against Western air defenses.
China is effectively using the battlefields of Ukraine as a live-fire testing ground. But China isn't the only Asian power integrating with the Russian military apparatus. This brings us to our final segment, the Korean Peninsula. Because the partnership between Moscow and Pyongyang is moving into highly sensitive domains.
The relationship is rapidly formalizing at the intelligence level. On May 29, Russian Security Council Secretary Sergei Shoigu held a bilateral meeting with North Korean Minister of State Security Lee Chang-de. They are formalizing direct intelligence sharing between their state security services.
What's the operational risk here? Why should we care if two sanctioned agencies share notes?
Because it expands the battle space. This could directly facilitate North Korean intelligence operations targeting Ukraine or its allies. North Korea has a massive cyber warfare capability. If they point those weapons at Ukraine on behalf of Russia, it complicates the defense immensely. It brings North Korea out of isolation and integrates them into a revisionist bloc.
This level of global interconnectedness, where Iranian drones hit ships, Russian troops train in China, North Korean spies assist Moscow, requires allied nations to engage in delicate geopolitical balancing acts. And South Korea's recent actions provide a perfect case study.
Yeah, we actually have to loop back to the Middle East for this. On May 4, the South Korean commercial cargo vessel HMM Namuho was struck by a projectile in the Strait of Hormuz. Seoul officially assessed the vessel was struck by an Iranian-manufactured GHAD-55 anti-ship missile.
So Iran shot a missile at a South Korean commercial ship in international waters. You'd expect South Korea to respond forcefully, maybe join the U.S.-led military operations to secure their ships, but they didn't.
No, they didn't. The South Korean response is highly indicative of the strategic constraints forced upon them. Rather than kinetic escalation, they've opted for extreme strategic restraint. They are attempting to secure transit for the remaining vessels through direct, quiet diplomatic consultations with Iran.
If you're wondering why South Korea didn't send warships, you have to look at the impossible tightrope they're walking. This perfectly encapsulates our whole deep dive today. U.S. partners are forced to navigate a deeply interconnected web.
Middle Eastern maritime security directly impacts East Asian economic security. South Korea needs that oil. Furthermore, South Korea knows Iran supplies drones to Russia, and Russia is sharing intelligence with North Korea. If Seoul angers Tehran in the Strait of Hormuz, Tehran could ask Moscow to accelerate ballistic missile transfers to Pyongyang.
It's a terrifying butterfly effect. A naval skirmish in the Persian Gulf could result in better North Korean missiles pointed at Seoul. This interconnectedness forces nations into complex, frustrating compromises with state sponsors of terrorism just to keep their economies functioning and avoid a regional war on their borders.
To summarize the operational significance of what we've covered today, the fusion of these regional conflicts is undeniable. From the contested waters of the Strait of Hormuz to the stalled battlefields of eastern Ukraine to the diplomatic corridors of East Asia, we are observing a highly integrated network of revisionist state cooperation.
The tactics are just bleeding across borders.
They are. Tactical adaptations move seamlessly between theaters. Thermal FPV drone warfare, weaponizing maritime choke points, blending civilian and military assets, and sophisticated sanctions evasion. Russia, Iran, China, and North Korea are learning from each other in real time. This synchronized activity is fundamentally altering global security, requiring continuous monitoring across all areas. You can no longer solve one puzzle piece without understanding the whole board.
And that concludes our analysis for this session. We thank you for your time, your curiosity, and your attention to these complex developments. Our intent here remains exactly what we promised at the start: to provide you with a neutral, deeply factual, and uncompromisingly analytical review of the operational environment based on grounded intelligence reporting, while hopefully making the mechanisms of this complex world a little clearer. But before we go, consider this. If authoritarian coordination has reached the point of shared military doctrines and privatized defense networks, how long until they establish a unified alternative financial clearinghouse that renders Western secondary sanctions completely obsolete? This briefing is adjourned.